welcome to the Development Policy Centre podcast. I'm Ashley Betteridge. Duncan Green, well-known development blogger, author of From Poverty to Power, How Active Citizens and Effective States Can Change the World, and Oxfam Great Britain's Senior Strategic Advisor, spoke to an enthusiastic audience here at the Development Policy Centre on September 12. The following is a recording of Duncan's public lecture, titled How Do We Plan, Campaign and Work in Development? The Reality of Doing Development in Complex Systems. Presentation slides are available on our website, devpolicy.anu.edu.au.
Thanks to the Development Policy Centre for organising this. Thanks for you guys for showing up. I feel like, given that these are difficult times for you, I think I need to start with a couple of clarifications. One is there is life after an election. Everybody in, many people in the British NGOs were head in hands over what's going to happen now, the world's going to end, and you just get on with it, and there are things you can work on and things you disagree on, just as you did with the previous government, and it's really, I shouldn't say this, but it's really not that bad, at least in the UK. It may be much worse here. I'll come back in a year and find out. But, you know, you've got to engage, you've got to start, you've got to think about what are the incentive systems and the ideological areas of convergence. There will be some, you know, Jesuits, things like that, and work with those and see how far you can get. You know, it can be done. So that's one thing. The second thing is, as an NGO, I am constitutionally obliged to complain, to say things are terrible, and that everything's absolutely awful, and, you know, and generally to cast a pall of gloom upon the room. So I'm going to do that, but before I do that, I'd just like to point out that we are 70 years into the most extraordinary age of human development that the species has ever seen. If you compare now with 1945, you know, beginning of decolonisation in much of the world, yeah, in which the Brits were kicked out and other people came in. There has been amazing progress on health, on education, on rights, on literacy, you name it, amazing progress. I was looking at the numbers over the weekend. In 1900, the infant mortality rate in New York was 100 per 1,000 babies. That is now the infant mortality rate in Somalia. There has been an extraordinary spate of progress across the world in that intervening period. So I just want to put that out there before I then talk about all the bad stuff. Okay? Good. So the subject of the talk is a fairly wonky one by my standards, which is aid in complex systems. And I think Owen Bard has already banged on to you about Owen, about complexity. And that was actually a slip. I really like Owen. I'm going to do it, but I'm going to do it a slightly different way. I'll talk a bit about complexity, but then I'm going to concentrate on the so what's, because I'm a simple NGO person, and I just want to know what to do differently. And I always annoy academics by asking them that question, and especially complexity academics get really irritated, but tough. That's the way it goes. At the risk of caricaturing, this is the world as seen by planners and campaigners, certainly in the NGO sector, and I would argue in the wider aid sector. It is a nice Newtonian system where if you lift up one ball in the Newton's cradle and let it go, you know what's going to happen. It's going to do that and that and that. And that is vaccines, bed nets, eye operations, workshops, campaigns. There's a very linear approach to our understanding of change. And I haven't put my mic on. Have I?
You've got it on.
Sorry?
You have it on.
I have it on, but I haven't turned it on. Oh. But you're hearing me through this, right? I'll stay here and not confuse it. Okay. But if you look at the world as it is, rather than as we imagine it, it looks more like this. Do people know this one? This is a US military PowerPoint. Yes, soldiers do PowerPoints too. There's a US military PowerPoint on Afghanistan. Okay, and when it came out and was leaked, everybody laughed uproariously at what a silly PowerPoint it was. It's a stakeholder mapping to shape US engagement in Afghanistan with all the different sort of actors involved and some of the issues as well. The guy who came up with it was sacked on the orders of General Petraeus, I recently found out. But when I looked at it, I thought, that's amazing. That's really good. Why can't Oxfam staff do things as good as that in countries? And of course, many, often they do, especially the Oxfam Australian ones, but in some cases they don't. And the point about a system like this is if you poke it with $100 million of aid or 10,000 US Marines, You've no idea what's going to happen. There are so many feedback loops and connections which will ripple through the system and feed into each other, and you know, waves and reflections will interact and all these sorts of things, that you do not know what's going to happen. And it doesn't matter how clever you are or how long you study this system, you will never know. That's the difference between complicated and complex. And the point is, most political, economic, and social systems look more like this than the Newton's cradle. And so what we do is either pretend that the world looks like the Newton cradle and find little islands of linearity that we can work on, vaccines, bed nets, cataract operations, you know, building stuff. Or we think, hold on a minute, if the world's like this, what do we do differently? Another way of looking at it is a framework devised by Dave Snowden with a name I can't pronounce, something like Kinedim, I don't know why he called it that, which says that there are, oh, do I have a little pointer thing here? Do I have a light? No, too risky. The bit I was talking about is complex systems over the top left-hand corner. Those are the unknowable, yeah, where cause and effect are very hard to separate out, and you work in a certain way. There are the knowable ones where if you study really hard, you can work out how to do it. There are the known ones which are simple and you can do it, and the chaos ones where you just wait for something, some shape to emerge. The metaphors for them are, you know, the known one is an eye operation. It's like you take someone's cataract out, their eye will improve. That's a straightforward process. Knowable is sending a rocket to the moon. You know, the if you've got a lot of clever guys and gals doing equations, you can work out how to get a rocket to the moon. Complex is like bringing up a child. Yeah, if you did a log frame when your baby was born and said, this is how I'm going to raise my child, these are going to be my inputs, these are going to be my activities, these are going to be the outputs, and the outcome will be a very happy child, you would probably be making a big mistake. Making a cake or doing operations, rocket science, and raising a child is a reasonable way to remember those three domains. But that's all very abstract, so I try and boil it down for simple NGO folk like me. And the best ones I've come up with so far is, how do you plan when you don't know what's going to happen? Right? Because in that Afghan situation, you intervene in the system, that's what development does and aid does, but you don't know what's going to happen. Okay, but you've still got a plan. You've still got to work out where to put your money, where to put your people, and what to do. So how do you do that? How do you plan when you acknowledge that the world looks like that map? For campaigners, there's a different problem. So NGOs increasingly do a lot of advocacy and campaigns. We're trying to change policy in the north, and increasingly we're doing advocacy and campaigns in developing countries too. When I got to Oxfam, I was told, it's really very simple. There are three things you need for a good campaign. You need a problem, you need a solution, and you need a villain. Right? You don't need a hero, because they actually quite often complicate things. It's much better to just stick with the problem, solution, villain. And it's an amazingly good guide to what is or is not a successful campaign. The trouble is, in a situation of complexity, you may well not know what the solution is. Okay? We know that climate change is a problem, and beyond saying, don't do it, we don't really have a great set of solutions which are going to work. So what do you do if you're a campaigner? Well, one thing is to pretend you have a solution. That's a fairly sort of straightforward thing. You say, you know, you've got to stop derivatives. Most people who are campaigning on that have no idea what a derivative is. But you say it anyway because it's a solution and people want solutions, journalists want solutions. Yeah, you've got to have the answer. Or you think differently, because you can do campaigning when you don't know the solution. So those are the things I want to cover tonight. The third aspect of this is, are we noticing what's going on around us? Did we notice the Arab Spring? Okay. Now, that may seem a dumb question, but for the first 2 months of the Arab Spring, the only people in Oxfam who reacted were the humanitarian people who respond to events. The humanitarian people were looking at, is this a refugee crisis or not? After 2 months, the people who do long-term development, the advocacy people, the political people, all said, oh, this is quite important, isn't it? You know, this is actually an opportunity as well. And maybe we should get involved and we should start funding advocacy in the Arab League. It took 2 months to do that. So that raised the question in my mind, are we set up to respond and even notice when these shifts happen in a complex system which we need to respond to? So how do you plan when you don't know what's going to happen? Planning for uncertainty. These are some basic ideas. Fast feedback. It's no good noticing 2 months later, especially because often rapid change leads to little windows of opportunity which you have to grab quickly. So you need to notice and react. You then need to come up with plans and ideas, and then you need to review and be ready to amend the plan. I'll do a bit more on this in a moment. Matt Andrews at Harvard has written a great but almost unreadable book called Limits to Institutional Reforms in Development. The title is a guide to the nature of the text. But the content is fantastic. If you can get through it, I'm impressed, and it's really good. And what he says is that given this situation, given the complexity, the job of aid and people interested in development is to focus on the problems, not the solutions. You identify problems, you investigate problems, you amplify. You get everybody aware that there is a problem. And then you create a space for solutions to emerge. And he came up with an equally catchy acronym to describe this process: problem-driven iterative adaptation. Yes. He's not going into marketing anytime soon, but he's a brilliant, brilliant scholar. And I think that idea that you should focus on problems and create the environment for solutions to emerge is a really helpful sort of thing to keep in your head. Rules of thumb. Oxfam's bestseller sells more than my own book, but it's not for that reason I'm about to criticize it. Okay? Oxfam's bestseller is the field manual project guideline thing. It's like this thick, and it has a page for every conceivable eventuality, and it will describe and tell you what to do. When the US Marines are rampaging through another country, they don't stop every few minutes and consult an enormous manual of marineness of how you do war, because that would not work and because it would be completely inappropriate. They work on the basis of rules of thumb. In the case of the US Marines, take the high ground, stay in communication, keep moving. Yeah? And the rest, you improvise and respond to context. That is a much closer description of what most aid workers actually do. They don't normally go around lugging this field director's manual with them and opening it every 5 minutes. They will then, when they have to write up a project report, pretend that they did it all based on the field manual, of course, but they will actually work on the basis of rules of thumb and instinct and gut feeling and all those other things which are not supposed to exist in aid and development. So, very important rules of thumb. Enabling environment. I struggle with this because In the UK, at least, discussion with DFID, enabling environment was always code. It's code for liberalisation. It's code for bunging lots more money to the private sector. But actually, the enabling environment is a very useful concept. It's saying that you don't know what specific intervention to do, so what you're going to do is to make the environment as a whole more conducive for solutions to emerge. Things like access to information, things like, in the case of accountability, making sure that all births are registered. Then all those people are potential citizens. How many times in developing countries do you end up in conversations about people's papers? My papers aren't in order, I can't do that because I've got my papers. Yeah, that is a basic prerequisite for exercising voice, all those other words. So think about the enabling environment, because although it's harder to do attribution, you can't badge it as easily, you can't put a big AusAid sticker on access to justice, it may well be a more useful contribution. Be a venture capitalist. I just like saying that because I work for an NGO and you don't expect me to say be a venture capitalist. Be a venture capitalist. The good thing about venture capitalists is that they try loads of stuff and they know loads of it is going to fail. Right? So they'll fund 10 startups and they know that 9 of them are going to go bust. One of them is going to flourish. They're going to make a killing on the one, and they accept that. Now, if I get a diff and say I've got a really good idea and I'm expecting a 90% failure rate, I'm unlikely to get my money. But we have to shift the thinking so that people will accept that if you don't try things and accept failure and learn from failure, you will get stuck doing the same things over and over and over again, and you won't learn. So trying to get a shift towards a more adventurous, risk-taking, venture capitalist mentality, I think, is one of the consequences of this stuff. One example, in Tanzania, actually DFID did say we could do this. DFID came to us and said, We're trying to do something different on accountability in Tanzania. Here's $1 million. Okay? You don't often have these conversations, but they're very special when they happen. And the Oxfam computer said, no, we can't accept the money because we don't have outputs, we don't have outcomes, we don't know what our success indicators are. It took us months to actually take the money from DFID. Once we took it from them, we said, okay, let's try to do accountability in Shinyanga, one province of Tanzania, and we don't know what's going to work, so we'll deliberately create a load of experiments. We're going to try some things other people are trying, we're going to come up with some new ideas, we're going to talk to loads of people, partners, accountability gurus, and we came up with 8 or 9 different projects, all around the same issue, which was how to get village committees to report to villagers about the village finances, which was in the constitution, so it's a gap between what's in law and what's actually happening, which is always a good thing to focus on, implementation gaps, but it wasn't happening. After 9 months, we made it clear from the beginning we would sit down with the partners, consultants, everybody involved, and have a shakeout. We'd agree what success was, and we'd identify the things that were more or less successful. We'd close down the things that were less successful, we'd scale up the things that were successful. Worked like a dream. I think we moved the resources into the better bits of that project, and DFID liked it so much when we called it Venture Capitalist that they gave us another $3 million, right, which is just language really matters. It's going to matter for the next few years. Make like a venture capitalist is a good general piece of advice. The other thing in planning for uncertainty is if you don't know what, if solutions are going to bubble up, how do you create the environment for those solutions to bubble rather than just to be stuck? And I think, example from Tajikistan, we had a water project which wasn't working in Tajikistan. We did a report which said, yes, your water project isn't working. We published the report. We didn't hide it. That was an unusual and important moment. All the other aid donors said, yeah, no, our water projects aren't working either. And then the Swiss Development Agency comes along and says, okay, we will give you a 10-year funding thing to find a solution. But please don't just do more of the same. So what we did was set up a talking shop. We've got 17 ministries, all the donors, aid agencies, INGOs, private sector, Tajikistan civil society organizations, all come together once every 2 months for an afternoon. We've got a charismatic water engineer who keeps everybody happy and makes them laugh and keeps them in the room. And then we just see what comes up. We just say, what are you doing? What do you think? What are the problems? And out of that, in the first 2 years, has emerged an interministerial committee because the ministries weren't talking to each other, a new water law, which people had drafted and then forgotten. And someone got it out of a drawer and said, yeah, this is quite good, sort of tidied it up, new water law. And money is now starting to flow, the government's co-funding some of the aid agency stuff, and other initiatives are just popping up all over the place. Now, the question then is, why does that work when so many talking shops produce absolutely nothing? Conference building measures, those sort of things. And I think the interesting, the difference is that you need a very specific problem and a very broad set of people in the room, rather than a very broad problem and a very narrow set of people in the room, which is probably much more typical of an Oxfam meeting. How do we end world poverty? Let's invite a load of NGOs. Would be the wrong model. How do we fix Tajikistan water? Let's have everybody. Would be the right model. That's my thesis, my hypothesis at the moment. I dread to think how you test that. Who are we employing? Bill Easterly. A NYU economist and a perky polemicist divides the world into planners and searchers. Okay? Planners are the people who are a bit scared of uncertainty, they like a good solid plan and they implement it really well with huge drive and energy, even if it's the wrong plan. Searchers are people who hop about in an annoying way and saying, yeah, but did you think about this? And did you think about that? And oh, look, that's going on over there. And they pick up things and put them all together and they try stuff out. I think in the aid business, we have a lot of planners and I think searchers are generally punished. They're ground down by sign-off and bureaucracy or they're not recognized and rewarded. And the question is, have we got the right balance of searchers and planners? And can you turn planners into searchers? I think this might be quite a deep psychological thing. Liking uncertainty and ambiguity is not really something you can be trained up for. I think you either do or you don't. So I suspect we need different people. But luckily I'm not in HR, so I don't have to sort that out. Results. Okay. I'm sure it's coming already. It will come with spades. Prove to me that what you've done has an impact. Show me the results. Give me the numbers. There's two kind of tribes massing on hilltops ready to clash in the plain beneath in development and aid, and that is the results people, the value for money people, and the complexity political science people. When they clash, if they do as they currently do, there is only one outcome. The results people will win. They have the money. And they also speak something like English on a good day. The political scientists are completely incomprehensible and have no money. So, how do we sort of get a fairer balance in that fight? Well, I think the answer is not to say I'm against measurement, which some people do say. They say measuring stuff ignores the complexity of real life and will horribly distort and ruin aid. Good luck to them. I think the actual much better response is, how do we measure stuff that matters? How do we measure the stuff that counts? How do we measure empowerment? How do we measure reductions in gender-based violence? How do we, you know, the stuff we care about, we have to get better at measuring, not necessarily totally quant. You know, can we get to a stage where rigorous and qualitative can appear in the same sentence? Yeah. That would be a breakthrough. If we can do that and show plausible stories about our work and what we think about rights and power and all that fuzzy stuff, then I think we can have proper discussion and we can have it. And the results people want to do this too. You know, the results, big discussions with the results people in DFID who swear that they want to measure this stuff, as long as you use a randomized control trial. So that's the stuff. Well, there's some thoughts on how do we plan for that Afghan map. Can we campaign on solutions, without solutions, rather? I think there's a number of things we could do much better. This is kind of a bit of an internal NGO campaign-y thing, but this is, I think, worth saying. I think one thing we're really bad at is actually the straightforward job of bearing witness, saying this is what is happening. Yeah? The you can't click on the Oxfam website and go to a village and see what's going on. Why not? Yeah? You can't get Twitter feeds, Facebook, you can't find out what's going on the ground. You have to have it all processed by us, intermediated by us. That doesn't work. So I think getting better at bearing witness is really an important part of. And you don't have to say what the solutions are. You just say, people are really worried about food prices. That's what we're picking up. Food prices are leading to neglect of children. You know, those sort of questions which come up when you actually do this sentinel site, qualitative, rigorous stuff, we're not making nearly enough of. Alternative is stay broad brush. Say there's a real problem with food prices and just keep saying it. You know, politicians, Fidel Castro, right, once said, repetition is a revolutionary virtue. Right? And I think, it's also a virtue in almost any kind of politics. Yeah, you hear politicians repeating themselves endlessly. That's because by the time they're sick of it, about 5% of the people have got the message. We get bored really quickly and move on and change our message. Broad brush, financial systems causing mayhem, food prices are a problem, stop there, find imaginative ways to do it, bearing witness or whatever, killer facts, but just keep banging messages, that's another option. A more time on whenever an NGO doesn't know what the answer is, they classically will say, more consultation. Yeah. Invite more people to your meetings. I once wrote a blog post on how to write the recommendations for a report on almost anything. And it's all about process and who's involved, and we need more data, and it has to be disaggregated. And you could actually write, and some of my colleagues said, bloody hell, I just wrote that report. So there's a bad side to default to process, that it's actually quite unthinking, but actually process is something that we can always focus on. So I'm kind of torn on that. The convenient brokering thing I talked about. So, one of the interesting bits of work I've been involved in is getting the trade unions, the NGOs, and the British supermarkets in a multi-stakeholder initiative, an MSI, to try and sort out labour rights in their supply chains. And it was fascinating, the dynamics, the building of trust, the constant fight between the NGOs and the trade unions was really interesting. The supermarkets we got on really well with, that kind of stuff, very important. And we created that space, and the trust was built so that when something like the Rana Plaza disaster happens in Bangladesh, all those guys were on the phone to each other straight away, and they came up with some really good, quick initiatives because they had the trust, they knew each other and how to work with each other, and they were able to do that. So there's another example, of convenient brokering at work. One which I've been skeptical about, but I think is worth thinking about, is just solidarity. We don't know the answer. Why would we? We don't live there. We're going to, you know, show solidarity with people's movements, with progressive political parties, with whoever we like, and that's going to be our contribution. We're going to stick with them through thick and thin and trust them. Now, that's very appealing, except that we choose who we're going to show solidarity with. So there's a kind of massive selection bias in terms of this is not the people, because you can't be in solidarity with the entire people. They don't all agree, amazingly, in any country. But so you choose. But it is, there's an aspect of that which is just trusting people in country and going with them that I think is quite appealing. So there's some thoughts on campaigning. How does this all fit together? And this is a kind of an attempt to summarise some of the thinking. I wouldn't say it's Oxfam policy, I wouldn't dare. I have no idea how Oxfam forms policy. But it's some thinking within Oxfam about how you put this together. Let me talk you through it. You decided you want to work on a particular problem for reasons of good reasons, like we decided that's really important, bad reasons, we've just been given a load of money for it, whatever. You're working on a particular problem. The first thing to do is a power analysis. Now, power analysis often just means a list of people you like working with. That's not a power analysis. A power analysis, if you imagine this room, right, in this room, I am like a visiting NGO person. I have no idea who is in charge of who likes who hates whom, who's got had really bad past with someone else, what's the relationships in this room? No idea. If I'm going to do a good liberate the oppressed of ANU project, the first thing I should do is try and make the power in this room become visible. There are lots of techniques and tools for doing this. First thing is to listen, ask questions, maybe get a consultant who works in ANU to come and help me. You know, all sorts of ways to make the power visible, see who's got more power, who's got less. And that's the kind of power analysis. Get that sort of map in your head. Make the power visible. Once you've done that, you can think, how might the oppressed people of ANU acquire more power? How might positive change happen? Is it a new government? Is it the death of a beloved leader? I won't go into any of that. I have no idea who that would be. Is it forming bonds of solidarity with oppressed students in other universities? How would that work? Yeah, and we aren't involved. We're just thinking how change might happen in this context. And then, and only then, do you think, okay, so as Oxfam, how can we help the ANU revolutionary movement? What would be our contribution? Would we do a bit of research? Would we do a bit of media work? Would we fly in revolutionary students from Chile? That's from Macarena, to explain how it's done. You know, those sort of questions. And that's your change strategies, probably plural. And then you assume that most of those are going to be a really terrible idea, and you decide when will we take time out from our organisation to review, decide what is and isn't working, and change stuff. And then you do the whole thing again. And that's what I think doing aid or doing campaigning in a complex system requires, not that sort of Newton's cradle stuff I began with. And that is the end of the PowerPoint. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you very much, Duncan. That was great. And your remarks about the power of repetition would really resonate with this audience of people who've just been through a very long election campaign.
What are the 6 points?
What we might do is take questions in rounds of a few. Clearly, it would be nice to get some questions on the topic of the talk, but I've warned Duncan that there might be a few questions that are a little bit broader and more topical. So go for life. So.
Thank you very much for that talk, Duncan. My name is Chris Hoy, and I'm a local resident. I just was wondering if you'd like to be able to comment on the communication of making a difference on the ground. So specifically what I mean by that is, in the Australian NGO sort of sector, there's a lot of focus in the community on administration costs, and there's a competition almost about let's keep our administration costs as low as possible, which sort of doesn't recognise, I guess, the complexity of aid and development. Specifically, shouldn't it be more about making a difference on the ground? I appreciate this isn't quite on topic, but I'd really like to hear your thoughts on that issue.
Thanks, Chris. Another question? Yes, just here.
Hi, my name's Irene Hout.
Hi, Irene.
Hi. You said be a venture capitalist. That requires money, which you also indicated. And but and in order to have money, you have to shift the system. So how do you get space in order to get the money to do the experimentation to be the venture capitalist? And I have a particular example about impact evaluation, where some of these impact evaluations that are done through mainstream methodologies, I guess, they get millions. And we were asked recently by IFAD to innovate and implement two full studies for $400,000. And so I'm thinking, how can we just, you know, how can you get the trust, or how can you get the space so that you're actually on a level playing field, because we're doomed to fail for 400,000. So then, you know, you show up as waffle again. So I think there's a real tension there, but you need the enabling environment in order to be the venture capitalist. So any thoughts on that?
Okay, maybe one more. Yes.
In a world where, in a world where aid is becoming an increasingly small amount of money that's flying around to change anything, and taking a complexity perspective, what are the catalytic mechanisms for having any sort of influence at all?
Right. I don't think we can duck the question of administrative costs. We could go around it in the sense that I'm not quite sure what counts as administration. So DFID, in order to boost its program spend, just gives huge chunks of money to the World Bank, right? That counts as program spend. So once you get down below the question, it gets murky, but you do have to front up and basically in a defensive way say, administrative costs, all UK NGOs are doing 40%, can we now talk about something else? And that's, I think you have to just neutralize it and move on. And you move on to impact on the ground. But when you talk about impacts on the ground, you have to decide whether you're going to be patronizing, condescending, and pathetic, or whether you're going to tell a sensible story. If your communications consist entirely of a tearful child saying, thank you, Oxfam, for my cow, then I think you deserve to get a slap at some point. If it consists of that and 200-page evaluations, even brilliant ones written by Rennie, I think you also deserve to get a slap. We've got to get better at telling good narratives, good stories about the impact of aid, which admit complexity, mistakes, failure, but tell the overall story, which I think is positive. And that's the bit which I think we're weakest at. You ready? Yeah, I'm not. So two ideas on how to shift the system in terms of funding. One is we don't do much donor re-education. You know, so everywhere I go, I tell the story of DFID in Tanzania and the Swiss in Tajikistan, because people in DFID and people in SDA and people in other aid agencies need to know that this is good and that they can do it. So we don't do nearly enough of that. Getting the sort of positive deviant stories of when donors rebel and do something different, and saying how good this can be. But the other one is it'd be quite interesting as an experiment to look at how did the random Easters seize the intellectual high ground? And what lessons could we learn from that? I once did this with looking at how Pinochet, the Chicago boys, took over the economy in Chile. I'm not just saying that, because that's a genuine one. And it was very interesting how they did it. They set up think tanks in the University of Chicago, set up think tanks in Santiago in 1955, 18 years before the coup that brought Pinochet to power, and they just worked their way through the Chilean elite. You know, long-term planning. So that's the kind of thing we need to think about in terms of the random Easters and whether we could learn anything for the forces of good. I'm not saying random Easters are evil. They're very useful in certain circumstances, but worth thinking about. Aid is becoming actually rather irrelevant in a large number of countries. It doesn't feel like that maybe here because of the state of the Pacific sort of question. But if aid is becoming less important, and middle-income countries. So there's a combination of factors which make people scratch their heads. Aid is becoming less important in most countries. Most poor people now live in middle-income countries where there are significant domestic resources. What do you do? Do you sort of gravitate towards the traditional sort of places where aid is big, where people treat you like royalty, and where you think you can control things? Do you go into middle-income countries with a new sort of attempt to do catalytic work? Do you focus on the new sources of revenue, like natural resources, and say, what can we contribute to the better utilization of those? Watchdogs, bringing in the Norwegians seem to be the standard answer to everything, those sort of things. And I think we're quite divided on that. And our understanding on middle income is that the role for NGOs, for international NGOs, is to support the strengthening of advocacy with examples from around the world, maybe some international support for whether where international pressure is relevant and useful. So to think differently and probably more advocacy based in the middle income countries, and then more traditional in the low income stable. But there's actually not many poor people in low income stable countries anymore. Something like 6% of poor people worldwide are in those countries. The rest are in fragile and conflict states, whether poor or middle income. And that is where everybody has to get together and try and work out what the hell to do, because that is, you know, the biggest risk factor for the aid business is it will increasingly work in the area where it's hardest to do aid, which is the fragile states. And we're all sort of blithely saying, yes, let's all go and work on fragile states. That's probably going to signify a massive backlash at some point, because you can't have, as Diffin says, zero tolerance of corruption, massive value for money, and work in Somalia. You know, that does not add up as a recipe, yeah, but that is where we're going. So I think there's some really interesting challenges on that side.
My name's Henry, I'm shooting here. In terms of how, I suppose, in Australia, aid funding is going to be cut, and other ways people are looking at developing, you know, doing development. My interest is in migration. And in Australia, I've never seen an NGO advocate for different types of migration, be it Pacific seasonal workers, be it more migrants from the Philippines or whatever. I've never seen the argument being put by these organisations that this is a way to do development. It always seems to be about aid money and aid expenditure.
Yep.
I was just wondering if you have a comment on that.
And this, yes, just here.
Wendy Jarvis, University of New South Wales. I found there was a little bit of tension in your talk on the issue of initial learning. On one level, you said rules of thumb, you know, gut feeling, whatever, Trump's best practice, and then you go and retrofit later on. And after that, but which tend to suggest you're not really advocating learning. On the other hand, you say, oh, we'll do lots of trials, learn from failure, blah, blah. Can you just say how you resolve that?
How I square that, sir.
Okay. Over here is Jim.
Yep. Dirk von Behrens from Campbell Friends of Delhi. One of the things that I wonder how you get it, apply your lessons, your technique, is how do you get to deliver the things that the clients themselves want, mm-hmm. rather than coming in with some sort of models from the outside?
Okay. So migration, remittances, as I'm sure you know because you asked the question, are three times the volume of global aid, but the literature on remittances and the literature on aid is like that. Something weird is going on. I think the NGOs have avoided it because they're more political animals than the economists. And the economists just say, well, why don't we just open borders? This is bloody obvious, you know, that will increase increase welfare and sort of... and is a good thing, and anybody who's at least slightly political knows that isn't going to fly. So there's a basic sort of problem that I think one of the biggest enemies of progress on migration are the proponents of migration reform, because I think they've got such a completely fundamentalist position that they alienate people. Doing stuff like campaigning on Barclays because of what they're doing on remittances to Somalia, that makes sense. We've done a bit of that. Yeah, finding areas within the existing system where you can make migration more pro-poor, very nice. Mexico has a system where for every dollar for social investment sent back by a Mexican in the US, the state government and the federal government match it. So you get $3 for each dollar to try and get, you know, money in. But actually a lot of conversations today have been about diasporas. You know, I've been quite interested in the amount of thinking that's going on about how do you improve the political efficacy of diasporas in terms of influencing policy back home. A lot of them want to do that. A lot of them not sure how to do it. Something that Oxfam Australia is doing with a number of different, it started with Darfuris. You know, how do you help them exert influence as a diaspora community? So lots of different things around migration, but asking for the abolition of borders because it makes economic sense is probably not where I would start. I don't think there's any contradiction between rules of thumb and learning, because you don't always have the same rules of thumb. You should learn and improve your rules of thumb, one. Two, rules of thumb are very general, And within those, you will learn, you'll do a lot of learning about how those will lead to solutions. So if your rule of thumb is always listen to the people in the community before you start doing anything, that isn't going to determine your solution, it's just going to determine how you get there. So I think, yeah, I think there's plenty of room for lots of learning and not having an enormous checklist. In fact, I would say having rules of thumb makes it easier to learn, not harder. I would argue. Feel free to come back. And that kind of goes to your question, which is, you know, in complexity, if you accept the complexity of systems, that should make you more, I'm not going to call them clients, more ready to listen to the people in the communities you would like to help, because they're much more likely to be able to find solutions and help you, help these solutions emerge in that kind of non-linear way than you can. So, and in particularly, I mean, I did a blog this week about a conversation I had in Dubai Airport with a gender advisor in Afghanistan. These things happen. About how do you do gender work in Afghanistan when no one stays for more than 2 years? The expats leave because they're on 2 year contracts. The Afghans go off and get better paid somewhere else, in the case of Oxfam. And so you're constantly, you have sort of cyclical amnesia. And you can't, and you never know enough to actually, just as you get to know and sort of half understand the system, you leave. So in that situation, you've really got to outsource the wisdom to communities, to local academic institutions, to people who used to go there and are now somewhere else but can come on Skype. You've got to find other ways to tap into the wisdom and then listen. And so I'd say actually this works in favour of being bottom-up and participatory, not the other way around. This is not, to caricature, this is not political economy analysis, where a political economist comes in, tells you why your program has failed, and says, and the answer is to commission me for another 10 years to keep doing papers about the political economy of your country. This is not that. Okay.
Wendy, did you want to take out that invitation to come back?
No, I actually sort of agree with you. But I think what you're saying is that learning in a complex environment, you focus on the how, not what the solution is. Is that what you're sort of saying?
Well, the solution will be different everywhere else in each place, therefore,
yes,
therefore the learning is about the how more. Yes, correct. Yeah, I would agree.
So we have time for just one more round. Well, come to you in a sec. Yeah, in the middle.
Hi, my name's Alicia. You spoke a lot about uncertainty and risk and being comfortable as development practitioners with uncertainty. Is there also a need to make the communities we're working with comfortable with uncertainty and risk, especially given that a lot of the messages that they're given from the international community are about results and success pretty much overnight?
Okay, Yelena again. I'm going to come back to results and enabling environment, because I'm thinking a lot of your story is about you have to have the room to adapt and learn, right? But the results systems are based on standardization and standardization of results, and all, you know, the whole system of results is based on very verifiable measures. So how do you, have you seen any signs as you've wandered around the globe of agencies that have differentiated their results measurement systems to recognize that there are some parts of their programs that are complex, you know, in fragile contexts, and so you can't know, and that's fine, whereas others, you're implementing known solutions, and people can be held account to predetermine results. Have you seen any signs of intelligence in aid systems along that line?
Just assuming the answer to that.
Duncan, I don't disagree with you about local solutions in complexity, but I wonder about your power in that, and the issue of information for people in order to derive solutions. So often they lack information about solutions to similar problems elsewhere, and what's the role of an Oxfam or any other aid organisation in bringing information into the solution-making process.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so when you say Are the communities we work with comfortable with uncertainty and risk? I'd say the communities have a lot of uncertainty and risk. They don't particularly enjoy it. That's like the fundamental characteristic of living in poverty, and they would like it dampened down. But that's a very, but that's a kind of personal uncertainty and risk. If the cow dies, we're not going to have enough to eat. It's a very different kind of uncertainty to the kind I'm talking about. In terms of partners, yes, I think we've done an enormous disservice to partners by creating this very crude kind of, I must have a project, I must show them the project, I must use all the latest jargon, I must talk about complexity or whatever, and then they'll give me the money and then I can feed my family and I'll be a briefcase NGO. I think we've created something which in some countries is not good. And how we, you know, I was launching the book in Nairobi, and people were passing up notes asking for money while I was launching the book, because we paper DMs as a way of getting people to come to meetings, and we created a culture which we really shouldn't have. But now you're stuck, and if you don't paper DMs, no one comes to your seminar, and then the results for the thing looks terrible. You know, so we've created our own problems, and we need to deal with that. So I think there is a re-education of ourselves and then having a different discussion. But I think any decent, you know, the closer you get to the ground, the more people say, yeah, this is obvious, right? The place where it is least obvious is in HQ, always. And the weird thing about politicians who run the HQ is in their political life, they totally get this. They don't know what's going to happen. They have to respond to the scandal, the event, the unexpected headline. That's what being a politician is, thinking on your feet, being nimble. Then they become a minister for development, and suddenly they want results, you know, plans, everything has to be predictable. What goes on in that sort of moment when they become a minister? I mean, something strange is happening in their heads. So can we get them back to thinking like politicians? That would be a big step forward. You ready? You know 10 times more than I do about all this stuff. So in a way, I should just say, I don't know, what do you think, actually? I mean, I've seen differentiation in terms of David willing to accept you changing the goalposts halfway. Saying we've done a midterm review, things are different, we're going to change the indicators, and they say, of course, that's not a problem. But in terms of a more subtle indicators for each of those quadrants, I haven't seen that. Have you? I'm guessing from the question that you haven't.
Well, you see many more agencies than I do, so.
Yeah, but I haven't seen that. But
maybe in NGOs?
We're getting there. I mean, I think that what's interesting in I've got this 2 or 3 years of work ahead on power and change. And the people who are most interested in this in Oxfam are the campaigners, who wanted lots of training about how you do this, and the monitoring evaluation people who want to start measuring good stuff. So I think that's quite exciting. I didn't expect it. So that was interesting. NGO power. So I know that when I talk about, you know, respecting, making the space for bottom-up things to emerge, there is always a danger of going into noble savagism. You know, oh, who are we to know? They are the people, they must have all the answers, and all that kind of stuff. And I guess there is a lot of that about in the participatory wing of the NGOs. But there's also a lot of recognition that we are not on a level playing field, that we have power, and how we use it really matters. And it's no good, you know, so it's no good the person from head office coming into the field office even, let alone to all the partners saying, oh, don't worry about me, I'm just going to sit in the corner, my opinion is just the same as yours. Rubbish. You know, he or she is from head office, people will defer to them. So you have to work within that system of power and understand it. And I think, picking up the second part, is that it's absolutely one of the, NGOs agonize the whole time about what's our value add. You know, what do we bring to this? What do we add to this system if we don't actually know how to grow anything? Why are we doing all this work on agriculture? You know, what are we bringing to the system? And I think that thing about exchanges, with people in similar situations, you know, when there is something like the Arab Spring, the first thing we should do is send in the lawyers. You know, we have lawyers and we know lawyers who have worked on constitutional reforms all around the world. You know, and then we've got 1,000 lawyers asking to work pro bono for Oxfam. In the UK. We don't know what to do with them all, but that's the kind of thing where we can actually contribute, both technical expertise, but also experience from other countries. We have to be clear about what we bring and what we don't bring. Yeah.
Okay, I think we might wind it up there unless there are any further burning questions. I'd just like to reiterate, we have a box of Duncan's books outside, and if anyone would like to buy one, Duncan will stay back for a while. Second edition was published a few months ago, substantially changed from the 2008 edition, taking into account what's happened in terms of the global food crisis, global financial crisis.
Responding to events.
Stronger focus on the private sector. Different book. If you already own the old one, throw it out. Buy a new one. All right, so please join with me in thanking Duncan.
Been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.